Hello and welcome to the final episode in this series of Bittersweet Symphony, a podcast about the lives of classical musicians during a global pandemic, when the concert halls shut their doors and the music stopped. I'm Cliona Ryan, a violinist, and today I'm talking to flautist Emma Roach. Emma's life changed in more ways than one in 2020. She gave birth to her son Charlie on March 25th of that year, during the first wave of COVID cases and lockdowns. She shares her bitter experience of being terrified and alone in hospital with her newborn. Her sweet recollections are of the community spirit and support she found in her neighbourhood in Glasgow, and of bringing Charlie back to Cork to meet her mum for the first time. Her bittersweet is her first day back at work, hearing the oboe give an A and the glorious sound of the orchestra tuning up, followed by the struggle of trying to play music while being so far apart. This is Emma Roach. Thanks so much for doing this.
You're welcome. It's been lovely to do, lovely to think about, so thank you.
Has it been?
Yeah, because I think about it a lot anyway. Every time there's a milestone in your child's development or their age or whatever, you automatically think, what would it have been like if there hadn't been lockdown, if it had been different? I think about it a lot, about the experiences of the past 2 years, definitely.
So you're from Cork. You live in Scotland.
Yeah. Live in Glasgow. Lived here since 1995. Came over to study, then just stayed. Just really liked it here.
You work in the Irish Chamber Orchestra. So anytime you're back, you're seeing your family. Your parents always come to the concerts. So your professional life and your family life and everything is still connected.
Definitely. I mean, pre-lockdown, I was definitely kind of felt like I was living, not living in between the both, but I was definitely working in between the both. And the fact that I was able to travel so much and I had reasons to travel home for work always meant that I had lots of time and opportunity to see my family.
Take me to the beginning of 2020 and what was going on in your life and where were you?
I think I was in the best part of my life in many ways at the start of 2020. I was heavily pregnant and loving every minute of it. I was working a lot. And so things, when my career were going really well, I was zipping around the place and we were kind of feathering the nest. But do you know what I was most concerned with? And I think this is quite common with freelance musician mammies. I was very concerned with when I would get back to work, if I would get back to work. And I spoke to a lot of people about it and people tried to explain to me, Emma, none of this will matter to you in a few weeks. You just have to let it go. But you just don't know what that's going to be like.
Yeah.
And I'd had a bad experience with one orchestra where they had sent a letter to people, which I had seen, sent an email saying, well, Emma will be out of action for the foreseeable future. What way did he word it? She will be enjoying motherhood, so she'll be out of action for the foreseeable future. And I thought, I haven't told you how much time I'm taking off. So he just assumed like I wouldn't be back. They were booking something in May. And in my head, I would be back at work in May. But they had just completely written me out of this tour in May because I was pregnant.
Wow.
The fixer, this orchestra, did not know when my due date was even. Had never even asked me that. Had no communication with me personally about it, but sent this email out to the rest of the wind section saying, who are we going to get to play flute now? I was out of action. That terrified me. But at the same time, you know, in some ways I was getting very well prepared for there being no work. So I had worked a lot and I'd saved up some money and I was, you know, at least I was prepared for the hiatus that was coming.
So your last day of work was when, Emma?
My last day of work was the 14th of March 2020, because lockdown here started a week later. Charlie was due on the 25th of March, so it was getting close to the wire. It was in the Glasgow, in the concert hall in Glasgow, and I said goodbye to all my friends, and that was actually the last concert in Glasgow. So the whole world came on maternity leave with me.
Oh, man.
And I had an appointment on this in the hospital on the 16th of March. And that was really terrifying because it was like the first time you went in and everybody was in the PPE gear.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to the nurse and she was saying, we don't know what's going on. She actually started crying as well. Two of us were crying. So I said, oh, I don't know. My parents aren't going to be able to come over now. And and this poor woman was saying, well, all NHS leave has been cancelled. So that was on Monday the 16th. And it was a week after that before they locked down here. And you're watching Boris Johnson telling you what's going on. Like, at least in Scotland, we had a bit of sense out of Nicola Sturgeon. You know, and there was a lot of WhatsApps flying around, like, what are you doing? Are people trying to get home? Because there was a lot of that as well. Will we just go now, you know? And also then our other complication is that my partner's son, so Charlie's brother, lives in Madrid. So he was supposed to be coming over to stay with us for when Charlie was born. So they would, you know, form a bond as brothers and everything.
How old is he?
He's 10 now. So at the time he was 9. So we thought about just, let's just zip over and bring him back. And if he gets stuck here, he can go to school online. But at the end, we decided that just would have been traumatic for him, you know, crazy. And then also Paul had a tour of America. He was supposed to be leaving 2 weeks after Charlie was born. So it was a little bit of me was thinking, yes, thank God, he's not going.
Yeah, yeah. When was Charlie's due date? And tell me about that whole experience of late pregnancy, giving birth in this time, if you're comfortable talking about it. I don't know.
I'm very comfortable talking about it. Actually, I feel kind of strongly that, you know, there's so many aspects of living as a woman that are taken for granted by wider society, you know, and childbirth and pregnancy, childbirth especially, is definitely one of them. Mm-hmm. You know? And I think that I have seen some articles in the Irish media, actually. There was a really good article in the Irish Times about new mothers suffering from PTSD basically a year into lockdown.
Yeah.
And a lot of people had to go through most of giving birth to a child on their own, you know, and it's just not something you were prepared for. And of course, neither were the hospitals prepared for that. So in my case, Charlie was due on the 25th.
Yeah.
So because of my very advanced maternal age, I knew that I would be induced on that day. And I think he'd actually started to make some little rumblings of coming out before that. Because thinking back now, I remember being here going, that's this funny pain. And I never thought it was Charlie coming out. Kind of think that you'd still go to work if you had it. It wasn't until the very end that I thought, ah, no, I wouldn't go to work with this now. It's ridiculous, you know. But yeah, so I went in and it was very eerie, and it was very strange because Paul wasn't allowed into the hospital at all. So we drove up to the door of the hospital and he let me out, and I waddled in with my little wheelie suitcase.
How did that feel?
I think I was kind of, you know, the way sometimes you get a kind of cotton wool head that you just have to do this thing. I kind of went into like robot mode, or I don't know, my body just started doing things.
Okay.
It was as if I was checking into a hotel. I don't know. I was in full on, oh, hi, everybody. I'm here. Hi. Oh, hello. So I went in and I was induced. And so it's on my own in the ward. There was one other woman.
Yeah.
Someone would come to take your vitals every kind of 2 hours. And you probably wouldn't see. I probably didn't see anyone else then apart from that. And to, you know, check how I was coming along.
What headspace were you in? What were you thinking and what were you feeling?
I was surprisingly calm, actually. I listened to podcasts, actually. I remember thinking to myself, I should probably change my clothes at some point, because I was like just fully clothed in the bed, sitting on the bed. And I remember thinking, oh, this is quite bad now. And thinking, trying to look at my clock on my phone going, is there not supposed to be a break between these? But I didn't see anyone to ask. I remember asking for, I was like, it's getting kind of sore now. Sort of chance of an old pippity painkiller. And they said, I know if you take any more now, your choices when it gets worse will be limited. So I thought, okay, what about a heat pad? And they said, I'll get you a heat pad, which took hours. Now, you know, I'm not giving out about them because they were really stressed. They were doing their best. But anyway, so about, I don't know, did I ring a bell? Or I think someone just came to look at me and I said, I had sore, like I'm sore now. And then she said, oh yeah, 8 centimetres. Now you better phone dad, tell him to come in. And I said, okay. And I was lying on my side and my phone was on the other side. And I thought, I can't, I'm in too much pain. I just can't. So I said, please, can someone get my phone? Can someone get my phone? And they were gone. No one heard me. So she came back 10 minutes later. She said, have you phoned dad? I was like, no, my phone is over there. And they were like, oh, for God's sake. You know, so eventually I got somebody else to hold my phone up so I could open it. And I said to Paul, I think you better come now. So he got to the hospital at 3:10. Charlie was born at 4:30. And then Paul was gone again by 6:30. So that was that. Here he was. And there we had little Charlie Stone.
And then Paul had to go leave.
And Paul had to go, yeah. That's actually one of my bitter memory is that.
Yeah.
When he went, I was still in the glow of it all, you know. And I remember they were pulling me backwards in a wheelchair and I was holding Charlie and I was like, bye-bye, waving to Paul. You know, didn't really sink in. And then later on, oh yeah, this is not great now. I would quite like to have someone else here with me for this bit with this brand new life that I really have no idea what to do with, you know. That was the really, and I think for a lot of people that gave birth around the same time, that was the worst thing about it. That's the thing that I get a bit angry about now, is like they ran out of stuff in the hospital.
Yeah.
Because visitors weren't bringing stuff in. So they ran out of formula. So if you hadn't brought any in with you, there wasn't really enough to go around. They ran out of nappies. They ran out of cotton wool.
Of course, yeah.
And then because of that, because there was no visitors helping anyone, again, all the staff were completely spread too thin. And so you couldn't, no, there was nobody else to hold your baby. Like now I know. There's no way a baby who's a couple of hours old is not going to like get out of their crib. But you're terrified to leave them on their own. So you couldn't really go to the toilet, change yourself. You know, if you've just given birth, you need a couple of showers, and couldn't do anything that took you away from the bedside because there was nobody else to watch the baby. It was just you.
Yeah.
So that's my worst memory of that. That's the only thing that I've spoken about so far that makes me just go, ugh, you know.
Really?
Yeah, is that time of not being able to clean myself up after giving birth to a baby because I was too scared to leave him on his own, you know.
That's your bitter memory.
Yeah. And it's a shame because it's my son's first few hours. But when I looked back at the photos of it, you know, I obviously didn't feel that the whole way through because I have all these like happy smiles and, you know, holding Charlie up to mm-hmm. me. And there was loads of amazing moments. And also, I don't know if you remember, but they did this thing that 8 p.m. on a Thursday, there was this clap for the NHS thing that was going on. And from my window, you could see people had come to the hospital to clap outside the hospital to nurses and doctors that couldn't go home. I get quite emotional thinking about this now. I didn't think this would happen. And you could see fireworks going off, and it was all for the NHS staff. And then when I sent a little clip of that to people, they were sending clips of like this street that I live on. Everybody was out banging their pots and pans. And I think they were solidarity moments in Britain rather than really about the NHS. They were about, look at us, we're all here. Again, I think our kind of get on with it attitudes as freelance musicians and women and Irish female freelance musicians, you just have this like, it was fine, it was not that bad, people go through worse. And then I found when Charlie turned one, and I was thinking about the anniversary of like, oh, this time last year I was doing this time, and that was the thing that really got me, like that wasn't good that time, you know, just please let me out, I want to get out. And they were saying, well, look, if you get out too soon, there's no coming back in. You will be on your own when you get out of here. We can't guarantee there's no health visitors coming to your house. There's no, you know, don't leave the hospital until you're ready and Charlie's ready. So that's the heavy bit of it, I'm afraid.
How long were you there with Charlie, the two of you?
I was in, so all day of the Thursday, and then I got out on Friday lunchtime.
Yeah.
So not that long compared to other people. I was very lucky. Like, I was surprised my good old bod that got me through 43 years at that time. I was very proud of it because it held up well, and I was fine. I was up and about, and I was, you know, grand. So I am thankful for that.
Are you able to name what those feelings were, Emma, when it was hard?
I think, you know, to be honest, it was like the word terror just came into my head because it was all about Charlie. It was all about this little person that I was solely responsible for. And I think that's a feeling that people have having a baby in normal times. Mm-hmm. But in this moment, it was just me and my instincts and this little scrap of humanity that I was responsible for. And it was terrifying. That was the main.
Yeah.
I remember, I'm going to cry again.
It's okay, lovey.
This is because my mum is actually here at the moment.
Okay.
I remember thinking I just wanted my mammy, you know.
Yeah.
And it's really made me feel for people who's, like a good friend of mine, her mum passed away when she was heavily pregnant, and it really made me feel for those people, you know, to have the I want my mammy feeling and know you're never going to see them again would be way worse than I want my mammy, she's not here right now. But I do remember that being a very strong feeling that just kind of, you know, appeared. And otherwise just very frightened.
Yeah.
I'd done all of these courses, the NHS course about what to expect in the days afterwards and what visitors would come and who would come and check on you and who would check on the baby and what tests you'd have done. And then people were coming up and saying, well, that's not going to happen. That was the worst of it then, you know, that bit. I don't think I'll be able to let that go for a while, but it's just one of those things.
Yeah.
It was terror, but also, you know, moments of peace and love. And there were obviously moments of looking down at Charlie thinking, no, who's this and where did he come from? I can't wait to get to know him. But it was scary. But thank God I lived in the age of video phones, you know. And my sister's a beautiful singer, and she sent little lullabies.
Yeah.
And actually a funny memory. I forgot all about this. This just popped into my head now. So obviously in Glasgow, the big Catholic Protestant thing is a big thing. And our go to sleep song in my mum's family is called O-E-E. It's a tune that I only ever thought about as being O-E-E, but it's actually the tune of the Bells of the Angelus. And you start singing, it gets slower, slower, and generations of my family have been put to sleep to that. So what did I start singing to Charlie? Of course, that's the O-E-E song. And afterwards I thought, geez, they must have been thinking, check out the Irish girl over there singing her baby like the bells of the Angelus. I mean, I'd never even thought, like, what did I sing to Charlie? And it just popped out, you know, obviously from some holding a baby memory, you know. Yeah,
I'm sure you've had so many sweet memories with Charlie and with Paul.
You know, I kind of struggled with this because it should be, right? Because he is the most amazing, sweet thing. But actually, the sweet memories of Charlie at this time, I'd have them anyway. So I tried to think of something that was a sweet memory that I wouldn't have had otherwise, you know. And it's, I couldn't really narrow it down to one thing. So it's kind of like the sense of community that was here in our little bit of Glasgow. And also amongst the other mammies, that WhatsApp group was amazing. It's still like the source of comfort and support and strength, but wider, just, you know, everybody going for walks. And there's a really nice tradition in Scotland where you put a silver coin in the pram, and people kept saying, oh, we can't even give him the coin. So there was one man, an outfit outside a shop one day, he said, hold on one second, and he got out his sterilizer and his hand sanitizer, and he like got a coin, and he was like doing it, and then he said, now you get out yours, and he gave it to Paul, and Paul sterilized it, and it was 50p, and then he was able to put it into the pram. So that's a really sweet memory of that community, and seeing the same people as Charlie got bigger and bigger, people putting up signs saying, do you need your shopping done, I'm going out.
Yeah,
that's definitely my sweetest thing about it. Was, of course, I missed my own family, but really felt like people were pulling together a bit. And I think there's still a little bit of that in the air. You don't think that's gone.
The thing about those conversations, for me, it changes how I feel in my environment. It changes my experience of my life.
But what I know of you, Cliona, you definitely were planning spaces to enjoy in your home and spending time there. And I was never like that. I was not really, I love my mum and dad's house, but I was never really a homebody. Like any of the flats I ever lived in were very functional. I was only ever there to get ready to go somewhere else or recover from being somewhere. I think if you'd asked me, I would always have rather be on the go than be sitting at home. I mean, thank God I had Charlie to have a reason for it. I think I would have gone spare otherwise. I generally think I would have maybe developed an alcohol problem or something would have had to fill the void. Like, and that, I think that's that bit of me has changed, you know. Having a little cozy nest is definitely more important to me now, I think, than ever.
And has your relationship with the concept of home changed, or is it?
I definitely feel more rooted in this community. Like, when we moved, we didn't move that far. We still stayed in the south side. And I really love where I live now. And I'm kind of happy that Charlie is from here. He'll have a funny accent. We'll just all have to get over that.
No, too. Emma, unfortunately, you might be the one with the funny accent.
yeah, that's true. My Cork region accent, yeah.
Are there any other sweet memories you'd like to share before we talk about your bittersweet memory?
Like, the most obvious one was getting Charlie home to Cork. Pulling into the driveway of my mum and dad's house, I nearly couldn't stand up, like, when I saw my mum laying eyes on her first grandson, you know, that she had given up hope of ever having in her life. So these whinies went from under me. Like, I had to hold on to Paul. Like, I was just in bits. And it was, I don't know if I've ever had that actual powerful surge of just pure raw, like, love going on, you know, just to see her looking at him. And yeah, it was amazing. I think as well, and this is a weird one, but like, I did a lot of teaching. Sometimes from here down would be Mammy feeding the baby, and from here up would be Miss Roach teaching the flute. You know, that happened quite a lot as well. So
amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing, isn't it? So I'm quite proud of that. So that's another personal sweet spot for me.
Let's finally talk about your bittersweet memory.
It's weird because it popped into my head as a sweet memory. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, oh no, that wasn't great, actually.
Okay.
It's the first time I heard an oboe playing an A to tune an orchestra in real life. And it was, I wasn't expecting to have such a physical reaction to it, you know. It was bits, like, it just, this noise of people tuning up, there's just that joyful, lovely, love that bit, the start of a week, start of a rehearsal, starting a new piece, music on the stand, brilliant. But we were 3 metres apart from everybody. And it was awful, like, you know, you couldn't play together. I was so excited to be back playing. And then the reality, when you sit in the chair and you go, but this isn't it. This isn't the thing I want to get back to at all. This is a whole new horrible thing that nobody should ever have to try and do. You know? And then hearing the A, and it was like that, still that same noise that just gave me that feeling. And like, oh, I'm back and we're playing. It's going to happen. We're going to do something. It was still that. That was still great. So yeah, so that's the bittersweet memory.
I guess for you, there was always going to be a before and an after because of Charlie.
Yeah. It's just that the after actually gave me the breathing space to just enjoy being a mum and not worrying.
Yeah.
It was a luxury in many ways to have just the three of us here in our little nest and getting to know each other. And, you know, we have a bond, I think, that maybe is a bit stronger than it would have been if I had gone back to work 6 weeks after having him. And, you know.
And if Paul had been away on tour in America, like a few weeks after he was born.
I mean, thinking, you see, that's the first time I've kind of thought about that, really, about that Paul doing that tour. And it seems ridiculous now that we even considered it, doesn't it? Like, it wasn't ridiculous at all at the time. It was a thing that lots of people do.
Do you think that, like, for example, you're at home at the moment now because you turned down some work because your parents are visiting? I just wonder, would you have made that kind of a decision before lockdown?
No way, never. Never.
It always would have been the work.
Yeah, well, you know what it's like, the freelancer mentality. Like, you can't say no. What if they don't ask you again, you know? I was more concerned with people not wanting me to do these gigs. I never, ever considered me not wanting to do them, you know? So you're dead right. That's a complete change. It's a complete 180. This is more important.
Yeah. Some other people, freelancers, through this time have realised that they're really valued. And I wonder how you feel about your kind of...
I'm very mixed, I'll be honest.
Yeah.
An amazing thing was that one of the orchestras I work with, they made a payment to all their extras. And they calculated how much to pay them based on how much work they'd done over the past 3 years or something. But, like, let's face it, if a pool of talented, skilled extra musicians is not available, then the whole system will crumble. And if you neglect your extras and their skill level goes down because they have to do something else and they're no longer able to do the job for you that you want them to, you know, that's, and I think that is happening in some places here, you know. Being self-employed during this obviously has been horrendous, but it's nice to have been a bit of a master of your own destiny as well.
Yeah. Emma, just before I stop recording, is there anything else that you'd like to say or share?
I think just, you know, when you contacted me about this, I remember thinking, this is like kind of what's going on in my head all the time that Lena wants to talk about, you know. I think you're right that we should be more mindful and considerate about what we've all been through, and definitely to take the sweet moments as well as the bitter moments is important. Mm-hmm. Because I think at the moment there's a lot of negative emotions, yeah, and feelings about the whole thing because we're just at breaking point with it all. And it'll be interesting to see in like 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, what will the collective memory of this time be, you know? It'll be interesting to revisit all of these kind of chats and see if we still feel the same way. Mm-hmm. There's something about, like, it feels very big to me in the sense of the way that we live was not sustainable for a lot of us.
Yeah. You know?
We were doing it because it was expected of us, but the kind of lives we were living, the expectations on us as human beings, especially as freelance musicians, it's kind of unsustainable what we were asking of ourselves and what was being asked of us, really, to be all things to all people. And I think this is kind of like a little fire break. That's the big positive that might come out of it, is that ways of working, ways of living, ways of spending time with people will all be a bit more considered and might change for the better.
I'm going to stop recording. Thank you so much. Thanks to Emma for sharing her experience. It's been such an honour and a privilege to connect with my fellow musicians. And I can't quite believe that this is the last one. I've been really inspired by their openness and their bravery, their warmth and complexity, and their humour and their strength. So to Aoife, Liz, Katrina, Cormac, Ida, Iselt, Chris, Catherine, Mark, Hannah, Steve, Anita, Dan, Elaine, Louis, and Emma, thank you from the bottom of my heart. I'm endlessly grateful. I'd like to thank all of you also, all of you that have listened, supported and shared the podcast, and that have shared with me your thoughts and feelings about it. Let me know where you are and why you've listened and what it's meant to you. I'd like to leave you all for now with a few lines I wrote for an RTE Lyric FM culture file piece way back in December 2021, just as I had launched the podcast. It was about my hope for Bittersweet Symphony and remains the same now as it was then. So what is my hope for Bittersweet Symphony? My hope is that it breaks down walls of silence and that our community find understanding, compassion and empathy in these conversations. For those that aren't musicians, I hope they discover something about who we are and about how we have been shaped by our experience since childhood. We dress in elegant gowns and tails, but go in and out a different door. Few people, except our colleagues and families, know how we live. They share our struggles and also know the pure joy music brings us. We are the people that play in the concert halls, the same people that play at your weddings and funerals, that teach your children, that play on the films and TV that you watch. And we are there in the shadows, swaying and playing along with your favourite band. These are our stories. This is Bittersweet Symphony.